Hey everyone, I'm your host Tom Shaughnessy and welcome back to Chain Reaction, a research-driven podcast that's a part of Delphi Digital. If you're not on Delphi's research portal, you're missing out on the critical analysis read by the top minds in the crypto space, so be sure to check it out. One quick housekeeping item, nothing said on this podcast is a solicitation to buy or sell any security or token or to make any financial decisions. I may personally hold tokens mentioned on the podcast, and you can view our show notes below for our complete disclosures. With that, let's jump into the episode. Before we jump in, we want to thank the Cosmos community for their sponsorship in making this episode possible. There are several projects building inter-blockchain communication protocols, but there's one that's currently built. Cosmos.network is on a mission to link every blockchain. Well-known projects like Terra, Band, Kava, and Secret use Cosmos and the Cosmos Hub to connect to every other chain in their network. The Cosmos Hub is completed and launched, and you can visit Cosmos.network today to check it out. The Cosmos Hub brings us that much closer to Web 3.0, and we thank the Cosmos community for sponsoring the Delphi podcast. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the podcast. I'm your host, Tom Shaughnessy. I also help lead Delphi Ventures. Today, I'm extremely excited to have on Andy. I think everyone knows him from Twitter. He's leading Fractional, which is an NFT fractionalization platform. Andy, how's it going?
Hey, it's going really well. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Andy, I have to open up with, I mean, every day at Delphi in one of our chats, I see one of your tweets get shared. It's incredible.
That's really funny. I like, you know, for a long time, I wasn't very active on Twitter. And then like kind of during COVID, I started to like tweet more and just shit post. And now at this point, it's just like kind of become a nice way to, you know, oh, I'm working on stuff, I'm doing serious stuff. Oh, go to Twitter, send some stupid tweet, or sometimes send a serious tweet. I try to have a bit of a balance between the two. But it was definitely not something I expected to have happen.
Isn't it? It's kind of wild, right? Like, I look for founders in crypto that like own the community, right? That are well known, that people like, that people love. It's just so different from the old world where you want to invest in a CEO who, you know, wears a suit and a tie. It's just, it's kind of great to have somebody as plugged in as you. I think it's a pretty big competitive advantage, actually.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely something I'm really thankful for. And a lot of it kind of just, I never, when getting into being like more involved, had the intention of like, oh, I want to get a lot of Twitter followers and stuff like that. And a lot of it just kind of like, it's like, wait, shit, why do I have this many followers? It doesn't really make any sense. And I still don't really get it. I think there are definitely better people to follow on Twitter than me. But I'm thankful for it.
It's a lot of fun. Oh, no, man, I love it. Keep it up. I love it. So, Andy, you have a pretty storied past in crypto, right? I mean, give us your story. I mean, you're at MakerDAO, you know, then you were pretty big in the Top Shots world. You know, give us your overview.
Yeah, so I got into crypto a while ago. And I mean, you know, I feel like everyone has their story of what made, like, what initially got them excited about cryptocurrency in general. And mine is not that exciting, but it is a little funny. It was early 2017, probably like March or so, and I wanted to put money on an offshore sports gambling website, and I didn't want to give them my credit card. And so I was like, oh, they accept Bitcoin. Let me look into this. And I like downloaded Coinbase and then saw what Ethereum, so like you buy Ethereum on there. And I was like, I wonder what this is, and started researching it. And I was like, oh, this is really sick. This is something I would love to learn more about, and just kind of went like downhill from there, which is funny, but definitely lost all the money I put on that sports gambling site.
Jesus, bad picks.
Yeah, I'm not a good sports gambler. I'm a sports gambler for fun.
But well, yeah, it's so kind of funny, like, you know, then you go to NBA Top Shots down the line years later, and it's such a success.
Yeah, I'll get into that a little bit, but it's been very funny, a weird intersection of things I'm interested in with Top Shot. A lot of like daily fantasy people who I've gotten to know in real life now that I used to like read their analysis and stuff. I used to play relatively serious daily fantasy. But yeah, so I was, after I graduated from school, I was working just like a normal fintech company. And then I was there for about a year. And during that time, I started to get pretty into crypto. And And so I left that job in the summer of 2017, and I found my way to a fintech startup in Flatiron District of New York called Hedgeable that no one has ever heard of. I was lucky enough that, like, kind of when I got the job there, I knew they were interested in crypto, and like I made it very clear with them that I was very interested in crypto at that point. I was trying to get a foot in the door. And it's funny, I had like interviewed at Paxos, I think, at that same time, and like it was so over my head that like they were talking about stuff I just did not understand at all because I was just super, super new to it. And I just got really lucky and found a place where I was able to kind of learn on the job. And we started building smart contract stuff into like an API that we were making, and got to just kind of do like some full stack development work around Solidity and stuff. And we ended up like also getting really lucky with hiring. And so the second person we hired to our like blockchain team was Noah Zinsmeister, who's the head of engineering at Uniswap. We hired him right out of getting his PhD and working at the Fed, which is funny. So we've known each other for a long time. And so, yeah, I worked there for about a year, and it was just like a really, really good learning experience. Didn't really know what I was doing for most of the time. And then I was lucky enough to get a job at Maker back right at the start of 2019. And so then I worked there for about 2 years. And that was definitely the most influential part of my time in crypto, because there's just so many massively brained people who were working on Maker and have worked on Maker and work on it currently. And I learned so much. When I joined, MCD was pretty close to feature complete, if not already feature complete. So I got to spend a lot of time learning formal verification and building out like the testing suites and all that kind of stuff. And then Black Thursday happened. And then it was a really, really good learning experience of kind of crisis management and dealing with large systems that are already deployed on mainnet, and kind of all the intricacies and complications that come along with that. And then spent some time like working on the new Liquidation 2.0 systems, which were tested pretty heavily yesterday and seem to be working pretty well up to this point. And then after that, I left Maker back in, I guess it was early November of last year. And I spent some time with a project called Element Finance, who you guys may or may not have seen on Twitter recently. They should be launching. I think they said they pushed back their launch date to sometime in June. But it's a yield protocol where you can split up your kind of your yield into principal and yield tokens and do lots of fun stuff with that. I got involved with that. I knew some of the guys who were doing that and had some ex-Maker people introduce me to it. And that's one of the great things about working at Maker too, is that there were so many people who were so connected everywhere. It's been a lot of really good opportunities have come up just from the network of people that I got to know there. And so I started working there because I was also pretty active in Yearn strategies at the time. And so I was able to help a lot with kind of building a lot of the mechanism design of how do we make our own strategies? Do we just integrate with Yearn? And I pushed pretty hard that we did integrate with Yearn, because, you know, building strategies in crypto is really hard, and Yearn knows how to do it really well. And so you can just kind of offload all of that to Yearn and focus on building everything else really well. Yeah. And so then after I worked there through February of this year, helped them kind of get pretty close to being ready for audit and everything. And then I started getting that same time working on Fractional, which is what I'm working on now and hopefully launching pretty soon, which is Fractional NFTs. But yes, that's the fastest possible journey of like 4.5 years at this point.
No, it's a great summation. It's kind of funny. I had Rune on from MakerDAO as like one of our first guests on the podcast, like 2.5 or 3 years ago, back when it was called 51%. He crushed it. But it's kind of funny you were there, because like, you know, those early days of MakerDAO, like we didn't have any of the DeFi apps we have today. It was all just kind of like an idea.
Yeah, it was really interesting. And I think even when I joined Maker, I didn't really understand just like how expansive everything in DeFi was going to get, and like what it was between that and Uniswap and then like the money markets we have, like all the insane stuff that was going to be built on top of that. It didn't really like fully register to me at the time, but it is cool like how much of Maker was a vision that, I mean, Maker started in 2015 being built on BitShares. Like Maker is ancient. It is like the oldest crypto project outside of like Ethereum and Bitcoin, basically.
Do you remember the those weekly interest rate calls were like the most happening thing in crypto back then?
Yeah, I mean, it's really insane how far it's come and just like how resilient it has been. But yeah, it was definitely a very different time. I would say it was hard at times because you're building all the stuff that like you think is really cool, but really the only thing anyone ever does with it is like go degen leverage long on Ethereum. so there were times where that was a little bit, you know, demoralizing as like there wasn't as much DAI supply as you thought there could be and all these different things, but it all worked out in the end.
Yeah, no, it definitely did. So I guess let's focus in on the NFT side of things. Tell us a bit about Top Shots and what you did there.
Yeah, so I'm a huge basketball fan. I've spent some time, I was never very good, but I would play pretty serious daily fantasy sports for a while. I was doing that kind of before COVID. I was doing that a lot. And then when basketball stopped for COVID and stuff, I kind of just fell off of doing it. No, I wasn't incredibly profitable anyway, so it's not like I was making a ton of money. But I'm a huge basketball fan. I obviously am very like crypto native, and I had signed up for Top Shot whenever you could possibly sign up for it, probably a couple of years ago, and had kind of just like forgotten about it. And then in late September of last year, I just like noticed an email from them, and I was like, oh crap, I totally forgot about Top Shot. Like, I should go check that out. And I saw that I had in August been added to the closed beta, which at that time wasn't very closed. It was, you know, if you signed up, you could get it in like a week. But so then essentially I just like kind of aped in really hard. And not for me, what was cool about it was that was the first NFT experience where like it clicked to me of why someone would want to buy one of these digital collectibles and own it, not just for the potential price appreciation, but also because it was cool and it meant something to them. And like, they just want to hold it. And that's true for a lot of the stuff that I have now with NFTs in general. But that was the first time where it really made sense to me, where obviously I thought it was a very good product and I felt like the prices were low and they could appreciate in value. But at the same time, there were times where I was just like, I really want this particular moment because I really like it. And I really like this player and it's cool. And so at the time, I was basically just like doing all the degen yield farming stuff and then taking all the profits in USDC and putting them into Top Shot. And so I
Top Shot competitive then, or like was it like, because it's always had quite a buzz around it. I mean, were you getting into Top Shots like before people knew about it, or was it, I feel like it's always had like a good amount of hype around it.
There was a period of time where essentially I don't want to say a number that's too off, but there were probably like 5 or 6 people that were making up like 80% of the marketplace transactions. And it was myself and a couple others who were just like driving the on marketplace volume. So I think there was a lot of buzz around it because it's like, it was the first NFT with like some really big IP that was like in production and doing everything, but there weren't that many users. We would, you know, I was in a group chat with two of the other, still am with two of the other like largest accounts, one of them who is like the second largest single person account, and the other guy's, you know, he's in like the top 10 as well. And we would like track the active users. And even in like December, as things were starting to grow a little bit, I think they were at like 1,000 active users over the course of like a week or something, or over every day. I don't remember the exact time frames, but there weren't that many people on the platform.
Yeah, that's it's early stages. And I mean, that was on Flow and you were kind of like an ETH native. Did that turn you off at all, or is kind of just like didn't focus too much on that? Or,
you know, I try really hard to not like put myself in the echo chamber of being ETH native and letting that cloud my judgment too much. That being said, like Flow is really the first and only non-ETH thing that I've done other than like buy and hold Bitcoin. But I try pretty hard to be open-minded with that stuff. And I'm still definitely still very much like an ETH maxi for the most part. But
oh no, I'm totally with you, man. I view crypto as one giant movement, right? Like, you know, Bitcoin is first, ETH was better. Like, if there's something better, you know, I'll move. I'll, you know, but that's, I mean, you got to evolve. So I totally get where you're coming from.
Yeah. So that's been my general feeling. And like, you know, if Flow has a lot of interesting things about it, there's a lot of, I think, very fair knocks against Flow. But like, to me, when I tried Topshot, the user experience and that whole, just the whole site and everything, and how clean it was and how easy it was for people to use was just like undeniable to me. And so I didn't really care what platform it was on. It just worked really well and it felt really nice to use. And to me, like with the idea of digital trading cards, the most important thing, even more so, I mean, obviously this kind of stuff matters because in the long term, you want to make sure that everything is secure, but the being able to actually have a ledger of how many are printed and stuff is like a total game changer for sports cards in particular. And so, you know, the knocks against Flow's security or whether the NFTs are custodial and all that is fair and like something that I would love to see change in the future. But at the same time, like it was just such a clear upgrade from normal sports cards that it kind of was an easy thing for me to jump into.
No, I'm makes a lot of sense. I mean, I shared a tweet thread a while ago just on like Netflix movies I would share to get people to understand NFTs. And I'm going to blank on the name, but I don't know if you saw it. Remember the top, I think it was Top Shots or I'm going to botch it, but it was the baseball one where the Ken Griffith rookie card was just overprinted. And, you know, the guy's dad's business was just destroyed over it. It was pretty wild.
I don't think I'm familiar with that, but yeah. And so like that to me is just like, it's such an obvious use case for blockchain, where you can actually verify that Flow isn't lying, that there are 49 LeBron James cosmic moments. And like, you could strip away everything else that comes with the benefits of blockchain. And if you just said, here is a, you know, normal sports cards or a totally custodial like version of sports cards, but you have the like verifiable ledger of who owns those cards, how many exist and all that, it's already an upgrade. And so everything else to me is like awesome and I hope it happens, but it's also just kind of like gravy compared to its current competition.
Do you think most people understand that in the real world? Like, I mean, I feel like it's not that hard to get, right? Like, I feel like traditional collectors understand that, but I think when you go into the technicals of it, like, hey, there's only X amount of punks, they're from this original contract, and yes, somebody can go create a new one, but it won't be from the original contract. Do you think people understand the technicals of it yet, or you think we're still a ways away?
I think we're a bit a ways away from that. It kind of depends too. I think at a really high level, normal people understand like blockchain allows for a more nuanced version of collecting where you have more proof of things, but I bet they can't get really into the details of what does that mean? What does it mean that you can prove that it's original and all these different things? And I think that's where a lot of the misconceptions in like mainstream articles and stuff about blockchain and like NFTs can kind of get lost, is they don't totally understand like, why is this actually important? And so then they start just like speculating and saying dumb stuff or just misunderstanding kind of what's actually happening and why is it valuable to be able to verify authenticity and stuff like that.
I'm totally with you. And I guess the idea of fractional is awesome. When I started to look at fractionalization plays, I looked at kind of the market landscape. You know, I looked at a lot of your competitors, but you know, you and your idea here and the technicals of it really sold me. But before we kind of get into that, and you know, just full disclosure, you know, we are investors in Fractional for those listening, you know, proud investors, glad you guys would have us. But to get into Fractional, I guess it begins with Topshot. Like, did you have the idea of Fractional with Topshot or did it come after?
So I think a lot of my thinking around fractionalization started with Topshot because that was the NFT platform that I was most involved in. I own punks. I own a lot of random NFTs that I just buy because I think they look cool. But Topshot was like, I was grinding the Topshot marketplace. I was very, very active. It was like nearly a full-time job for me. And so it was just what I was thinking about all the time. And so that was kind of where the thoughts started. And so a lot of it came from conversations I was having with the same like collectors where we would talk about strategy and stuff. And there were particular times where you'd see a moment and be like, okay, this is worth, you know, it's listed for $10,000 and I think it's worth $500,000. But who is the addressable marketplace of people that have $500,000 and want to buy this gift from me? And clearly, like my kind of my numbers of what people would be willing to spend was way off, thankfully. And so, but the question still stands, but now it's, you know, I can buy this thing for $200,000 or $1 million. And I think it's worth $50 million. And who are the people who can and want to buy this thing for $50 million. And so that was kind of where I first started thinking about it. And then there were a lot of people from outside the crypto space coming in and buying Top Shot moments as a group. And that was, so kind of Top Shot, when it got like really propelled into the mainstream, was from this article by a guy named Jonathan Bales. He's a really smart dude. He was one of the founders of Fantasy Labs, which is a daily fantasy like sports site, not for actually playing, but like analytics and stuff like that. And he's a successful daily fantasy sports player himself. And so he and some friends bought one particular moment for like $35,000, which at the time was like crazy. It was a lot of money for a Top Shot moment at the time. And he wrote like a really awesome article about it. And that kind of like really kicked things off. But like that purchase was made by, you know, like six or so guys who all pooled together capital and bought it. And since then, a lot of the big purchases have been two or three people or even larger groups buying these big moments. And that just made it even more clear to me, like there's serious demand for this. And also there's demand for it outside of just crypto natives. Like these are not, you know, I've found myself in a very fortunate position now where I'm friends with a lot of these guys, and some of them are even investors in Fractional, and they're not crypto native. They have gotten into crypto through NFTs, and they're just another group of people who are interested in alternative investments and are open to crypto and NFTs. And there was real demand for this, like to them. And so that to me was very interesting, because it made it seem like there was a serious like product market fit for people who aren't just like diehard ETH DeFi nerds who are like doing all this other like crazy on-chain stuff.
It's kind of crazy that you bring up people coming together to buy NFTs and like, you know, basically escrowing money. It's kind of like the reverse of what you want to do in a way, right? You know, these people are like escrowing their funds together and then buying one unit or one NFT. Whereas through Fractional, you're going to break up that NFT. So these guys don't really have to go through that or even organize.
Yeah, exactly. And so like, it's just taking what they're doing and deconstructing it into a trustless and like cleaner version of what they want to do. And it makes sense to me in that sense.
No, it totally does. And I want to go into the specifics of the platform, but just at a higher level, like, what are the main benefits of fractionalizing an NFT, right? Like there's a lot of answers to this. Like in my mind, I guess, you know, you obviously allow more people to buy in, you have more price discovery, you know, things like that. But I guess it gets a little murky when you have different forms of NFTs, right? Like if you have a piece of artwork, I guess it's relatively easier. If you have like something like an Axie that you want to battle with, I guess it becomes a little bit harder. How do you kind of think through the benefits and I guess the differences for different types of NFTs?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And I think you really, there's, to me, and in my opinion, there's going to be in the long term, like two primary ways that people go about fractionalizing things. And one of them is going to be like full on DAO governed NFTs that are fractionalized and owned by a DAO. And maybe they're holding multiple NFTs, and then they're, you know, so say they're buying Axies and they're using them and playing with them and earning. And then I think there's going to be another version of fractionalization, which is just the really, really basic, like easy to use version where you just lock up an NFT and turn it into ERC20 tokens and then say, you know, have fun with these. If someone buys it out, you get your Ethereum back. And so I think that different NFTs are going to lend themselves to different versions of fractionalization. And so I do think there are particular things that require like serious overhead that probably are better suited to be in a DAO, like a like an Axie or something, where there's a lot of different moving parts with an Axie. And so like putting that into a lazy version of fractionalization, outside of, you know, if you want to be doing all those moving parts, it might not really work out very well. Or maybe not work out very well. It's just, you know, you're not going to be maximizing what you can do with it. And so that, so the benefit there is when you fractionalize through a DAO style thing is, so there's a few different interesting things. Is one, you can like really separate like duties. And so if you think about like a Zed run, I know that better than Axie, so I'll talk about that, but you can have different people in the DAO who own fractional shares, breeding horses and racing horses and like managing sales and all of that. And like it's a full-time job to manage a large stable in Zed. It's a lot of work. And so stuff like that is really valuable. And then when you get to the like less, I don't want to say less useful assets, but you know, more static NFTs, I think that the cool thing with fractionalization, if done in a way that feels right, is you can really have like a feeling of shared ownership where you can feel like you can own an NFT that you otherwise could not own. Like I have a lot of people who I've spoken to who would really love to own 1/10 of a LeBron James Cosmic or 1/100 of an Alien CryptoPunk, but they could never own a full one. And so I think as long as you kind of build it the right way and make sure you're aligning incentives, that like ownership of these really important assets to people, because I think over time, like cultural importance of things is going to continue to be more and more digital. And so being able to be a part of those things is really valuable to a lot of people.
It's kind of a tangential question, and I love your answer, but a lot of the cool things about rare NFTs, like having a very rare punk, having a very, you know, meaningful Top Shot moment, is like the ability for one person to display it. Like, you know, hey, here are my NFTs, you know, hey, I'll lend them out to a museum or check my wallet, yada, yada. When you own part of it, how do you think people are going to be able to share that? Like, are people going to share the entire punk and say, hey, I own 1% of this? Or how do you think people are going to go about that aspect of it?
Yeah, I think that's actually, you know, outside of the mechanism design of fractionalization, which obviously is very important, I think that's probably the most important problem space with fractionalization is making sure that people do really feel like they have ownership of these assets, because you do, but you know, you own 3% or you own 5% or something. I think, you know, I've been actively talking with a few of the different people who are building either NFT social platforms or different like types of curation platforms, and trying to figure out ways for more off-chain style, like less you have to do this, but more opt-in style governance over these fractional NFTs, where you can maybe like put up a snapshot vote to let that NFT be displayed in a crypto voxels museum or something. And then at that point, you know, a lot of that is just going to end up being more like social contracts than anything. But that's the case with NFTs in general. Like, you know, an NFT on like a digital museum can display whatever NFTs they want. We, for the most part, it's not really like, it's mostly just you've agreed to the social contract of what you're building. But I think stuff like that'll be really interesting. And then also, I think trying to figure out a way for wallets to display these things as NFTs and not as ERC-20 tokens will be really valuable there. And whether that's just like collaborating with wallets to do that or figuring out some interesting on-chain mechanisms for that, I think that'll be really cool, is being able to see those things as NFTs that you own and not just as another ERC-20 token that you own.
No, I'm totally with you there. And the sense of community and ownership you get is pretty wild, right? Like, I mean, everyone loves CryptoPunks, right? But there's only, you know, what, 10,000 owners? So, mm-hmm. I mean, having, well, I guess 10,000 on-chain owners, I guess if they all come together off-chain, there might be more partial owners. But I guess that sense of community is really hard, right? Like, I would love for, you know, if I could go to the Delphi guys and say, hey, guys, want to go in on a punk? Like, it's such an easy decision for everyone to just say yes to.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And I've actually seen, I saw a really interesting question the other day on Twitter, I think from Loopify, who's, you know, a big NFT collector. And they were talking about, you know, a fractional, if you had a fractionalized punk, are you allowed to set it as your profile picture? And that was really funny for me to read that, because it's like, you're allowed to set whatever you want as your profile picture. That's not how this works. Like, that's not how Twitter works. But it's interesting that like, that's the way that that conversations around ownership and like all of that goes, is it, there's such a strong social contract especially in CryptoPunks, but I think in NFTs in general. And it'll be very interesting to see how people end up and how the community ends up feeling about fractionalized assets, because they're coming. There's going to be a lot of them. But are you allowed, if you own a basket, if you own 10% of a basket of 15 alien or 15 CryptoPunks, are you allowed to set your, or like, is the social consensus of Twitter going to be fine with you setting your avatar to one of those CryptoPunks? It's such a weird and there's no real answer. It'll just be interesting to see how that all plays out.
Like, hey, bro, you know, you're using my punk as your, you know, picture, prove it on chain kind of thing.
Yeah, I've actually been talking to someone about the idea of making a Chrome plugin called Proof of Punk or something, where you could sign a message and prove that you own the punk that's in your Twitter profile picture or something. And you could just almost like a blue check mark, but for actually owning your NFT avatar. Something like that'd be pretty cool.
Yeah, no, it totally would. I mean, especially as everyone goes online. And Andy, just to I want to focus a bit some more focused questions just on fractional itself, right? Let's say somebody logs onto the site, connects their wallet, and let's say they have, you know, let's just use a punk, for example, because they're pretty well known, or Top Shot, whatever you want. Could you kind of just walk me through the process of how somebody would fractionalize it? And then I guess after you answer, we could kind of go to the user side of it.
Yeah, for sure. So one of the things that we're focusing on a lot is being very unopinionated as far as what you should do when you come and fractionalize. I think it's important letting people really build on top of what we're making. So when you come to the site and you want to fractionalize something, you're going to, let's say it's a CryptoPunk, you'd have to wrap that CryptoPunk into a wrapped CryptoPunk. So it's a ERC-721, but that's just kind of semantics. And so then from there, you would mint what we call a vault, and that vault would transfer, it would do a transfer from of your punk into the vault and then give you back ERC-20 tokens. And when you do that mint process, you can, you know, set the name of the tokens and the symbol and total supply and all that stuff. And you also are going to set what we call a curator fee. And so this fee is paid in the form of total supply inflation. So say you set a 5% curator fee, then over the course of the year, 5% of the token supply would be minted and sent to your wallet. And so, you know, initially, I think this is an interesting way to kind of incentivize fractionalization. You know, if there's really high demand to buy fractional assets, like say a fractionalized alien punk, there's no reason that the person who's providing that punk shouldn't be, you know, seeing some type of payment for that outside of just selling the fractional shares. And then in the long term, it'll be very interesting to see kind of where the market settles on curator fees and what that plays out like. But I do think there's some interesting applications around artists directly launching with curator fees and kind of having that as a form of secondary market sales as opposed to actual secondary market sales, different things like that. But essentially, it's an asset under management fee that you set for yourself. And so at that point, you would get all of the ERC-20 tokens. The protocol itself does not care what you do with them. At that point, you now have all the tokens. You can do with them whatever you want. There's a million different ways that you can sell a token. And so maybe you don't even want to. Maybe you have a bunch of friends who you want to share ownership of a punk with, and one person buys it, and then they put it in fractional. They set all the fees to zero, and then you just send it out to all your friends. And now you all fractionally own a punk in a trustless way. Alternatively, you could we'll be able to guide you and write up lots of guides on doing Dutch auctions or going to Sushi and using their new Miso platform or providing a limit order on Uniswap, all that stuff. But the site itself isn't going to, the protocol itself isn't going to force you to do anything with those tokens. But yeah, so that's essentially the minting process.
Makes a lot of sense. I have a bunch of questions here. I got to play the dumb host again, as I normally have to do, but just to, you know, make sure the story gets across. But so the curation fee is pretty interesting, right? So if I'm understanding correctly, what you do is whoever wants to fractionalize their NFT or basket of NFTs, they mm-hmm. have a fee every year. And basically it's just diluting everyone else's ownership so that yes. they get more, but it also allows more units to go out in existence to help increase the amount of fractionalization and, you know, yet owners, I guess.
Yeah. So, you know, there's like a million different things you can do with this, which is what I think is exciting about it. One, if people have no stomach for a curator fee, you know, maybe you set one to 10% and people are like, not buying this thing for 10% annual inflation. I'm just not going to buy it. And then you can set it to zero and say, okay, fine. No curator fee. The other thing that's interesting is so the fee is initially rooted to the address that initially locks up the NFT. But that doesn't have to be the case. You can also change that. So like I was talking with someone who has a really valuable MeBit that they're thinking about fractionalizing. And they were talking about changing that fee to be paid to MeBit's DAO. And so then they would fractionally sell the MeBit, and then MeBit's DAO would basically have reoccurring income. And so then you're incentivizing a community to maintain the fractionalization of this thing, and then it becomes a revenue stream for them. Or alternatively, what you could do is you could take that curator fee and you could route it to a liquidity mining contract. And
I was just going to ask that.
That's what I'm actually most excited for. And so basically, if you are providing liquidity for that token and, you know, DAI or Ethereum or whatever you want, you could then have liquidity mining where you would earn more of the token and dilute people who were not providing liquidity. And I think that's like extremely interesting and something that I'm really excited to see kind of like play out in the wild at some point.
Frankly, yeah. I mean, you could even let people, I mean, if they come to Fractional, I mean, you could even let them choose the curation fee and then let them choose like, you know, a Uniswap or SushiSwap kind of, you know, ongoing fee for liquidity mining and set that at 1%. I mean, that would be super interesting, just like automate the incentives around trading.
Yeah, for sure. It's something that I'm actually working through a pretty intense version of this that would, so maybe this is getting a little bit too into the weeds, but essentially what it would do is one of the hardest parts with fractional NFTs is liquidity and general like large trades, just because, you know, they're not insanely high. Most of them are not going to be insanely high market cap things. And so just on a normal AMM, like SushiSwap or something, you're going to have a lot of slippage when you're trying to trade these things for more than a couple $1,000. And so one of the things that I'm interested in trying is basically like using a smart LP vault on Uniswap V3. So you can have like a very, a much tighter liquidity pairing and potentially a lot more depth in your trades. And then having all of the curator fees routed to that vault as liquidity mining rewards. And so then you could have potentially some like really deep liquidity for an NFT that isn't actually, you know, it doesn't have to be a $100 million NFT for there to be really deep trade liquidity at that point. And so that's something that I've been experimenting with kind of for a, not really like a V2, but a later rollout version of this.
That's incredible. There's so much we could jam on there, but just to zone back in on like the creation. So when somebody comes to you and they want to, I guess, get the NFT out there, you said that they could basically do whatever they want with the different shards. What do you think will probably be the easiest way for people to get the shards out there outside of like the more private aspects where somebody just sends to a group of friends?
Yeah. So, no, I feel like a lot of people do the balancer liquidity bootstrapping pools. You know, I see a lot of projects do those these days. I wouldn't be shocked to see though that be a popular way to do things, especially as with Balancer V2. I to be honest, I'm a little bit uneducated on some of the complexities there. It's something that I need to spend some more time researching. I think that the new MISO platform for SushiSwap could be really valuable here. I wouldn't be shocked to see that continue to gain adoption because it, you know, it is essentially doing exactly what you'd want here, is you just go there and decide exactly what type of sale you want, and then just deposit however many of the tokens you want, and it'll handle it for you and seed a liquidity pool. And then lastly, I think the more basic, but I wouldn't be shocked to see this pop up just because Uniswap is so massive, is you can do a ranged liquidity order on Uniswap and just only provide that asset and then just kind of let the market trade in, and then you'll start earning your other at like whatever you pair it with.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I mean, the LBP pool could be pretty interesting too, especially because you know there's no kind of reason to ape into it to start. But yeah, definitely more to jam on there.
Yeah, I think the space for launching these things, there's a lot that's possible. And really, a lot of it comes down to just like, what's going to get the most eyes on these things, especially, you know, there's going to be some really high profile stuff that's fractionalized over the next couple of years. And it doesn't matter where they launch. There's going to be people who want to buy it, and people are going to figure out how to buy it, and that won't be an issue. But when you're, you know, if you're just someone who has a CryptoPunk and you decide you want to fractionalize it, that's significantly harder. If you're just some random guy who has one CryptoPunk, how do you get the eyes on there to know that it's even happening and to have there be some demand for it? That'll be the interesting side of things, I think, where there's a lot of room for some ideation around what's best.
Yeah, no, I'm totally with you there. I mean, just thinking out loud, I mean, doing something like, I don't know which is best here, like the bootstrapping pool or UniorSushi, you know, just off the top of my head. But if you're able to link that curation feed to wherever you do the primary issuance, like that would be awesome, because you just, instead of having like two fragmented, you know, primary secondary venues, you basically just tie it all into one, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And that's one of the things that we're trying to like with
our. Yeah, no, not totally sure the best route. Oh, sorry. Yeah. I lost you there.
No, that's right. I think that's one of the things we're trying to be pretty open-minded with too on our platform is like, you know, we want to make sure that people can swap these assets on the platform, but we're not going to, you know, we're not integrating with one particular thing. We're going to just like integrate with like 0x API or something and make sure that you can, you know, hopefully in the long term, we can kind of just have really give people a suite of options where they can do whatever they want, and we'll be able to support all of those things kind of natively. I think that's really the best way to go, is give people a lot of optionality.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And, you know, one of the things I loved about Fractional was putting all the pieces back together, right? Like, you don't want these, I guess, zombie shards or anything like that. And the way you guys handle it versus your competitors, I'd rather focus on, you know, the specifics around what you guys are doing. Your buyout mechanism is very, very straightforward. Could you kind of dive into how the pieces get put back together? Because it kind of starts with the initial reserve price to begin with.
Yeah, for sure. And I think one of the things that we've really been focusing on, as I said earlier, I think there's kind of going to be two forms of fractionalization, and that's going to be really intense DAOs that own assets and use them and do all this other stuff. And then I think I feel very strongly that the other version that's going to be popular is what I call lazy fractionalization, or just you know, something that really doesn't require a ton of end user input. And so that's something that's been a big focus of ours up to this point. And so the way that we have the buyout structure right now is through an auction. And the reserve price for that auction is initially set by the curator that's what we're calling the NFT originator. The curator, when they come and they mint this thing, they set a reserve price. And that is the price in Ethereum that you would need to be paid to trigger an auction, kind of essentially like, you know, if you've done an auction on Foundation or any of these other NFT native auction sites, you've probably seen something similar. And so the reserve price is voted on by all of the token holders. You don't have to vote, but you always have the option to. We have a quorum kind of, you know, at least this many people have to be voting, so you can't have some, you know, crazy outliers or something by a couple people voting and no one else participating. And then at that point, we just take a weighted average of everyone's votes. Ideally, in the long term, I think we might want to try to move to a median, but it's a significantly more complex on-chain calculation than an average. And then we don't allow you to have some crazy outlier votes. And then at that point, we have a kind of a constantly calculated reserve price, where at any time, someone who has enough Ethereum can come in and trigger a buyout. But yeah, that's kind of how our recapitalizing an NFT works. I think one of the things that I feel pretty confident on is it is important to make sure that having buyouts and having NFTs, you know, taken out of the system, I think is really healthy, and is something that should definitely be possible, and not like a thing where it's like, oh, theoretically it could be bought out, but it probably never will. I think that's unhealthy for the system. I think people want to know that they're, you know, when you're buying into these things, there is the chance that someone's going to buy the whole one.
No, I mean, it's super important. And I mean, the thing that I love about your buyout mechanism is you're not using an arbitrary percent like other projects, right? You're not saying, hey, X percent is needed to vote yes on some buyout price, because the reality is the way fractional works is that it doesn't really matter what percent. It only really matters the people that are actually active in setting that reserve price. So, I mean, if only a certain number do, then it matters. But the great thing is those that own more of the shards have obviously more of a say in the reserve price, which is kind of genius.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate that. I think it's definitely important to be able to kind of allow people to have more of a say, but also if you don't feel like voting and that's just not important to you and you just want to buy it and trust everyone else will do the right thing, you like completely have that optionality.
No, that it makes so much sense. So just to recap, because I want to make sure everyone is following it and I understand it correctly. So every holder sets a reserve price. So let's say there's, 100 holders and everyone, sets, let's say they buy a punk or part of a punk, and let's say they all think it's worth 100 grand, whatever that is in ETH. They'll all set, like, let's say different reserve prices, like some will set, 90K, some will set 120. And based on their pro rata ownership, you get basically, kind of like an average reserve price. And obviously people don't have to set a reserve price and then they're just not counted in the average. And larger holders of shards obviously have more say pro rata to move that reserve price. And then anyone can send that amount of ETH to start an auction to buy it out. And the auction could obviously increase from there.
Yeah, exactly. And so I definitely felt that having an auction there as opposed to like an immediate buyout is important. I think it helps a lot with the game theory around kind of, trying to manipulate the reserve price and stuff, because, at end of the day, if you want to spend all the gas fees to like buy a bunch of tokens and try to manipulate the reserve price, like you might just get outbid in the auction anyways, and then you just wasted a bunch of money. And so I think that was that was like kind of a key thing there to just make sure that there's appropriate price discovery when the time comes for a buyout.
And how does it work? I guess, let's say, somebody starts the auction, they have enough ETH, they want to buy this complete NFT or basket. They start an auction and let's say that person wins. How do people exchange their shards for, I guess, the amount of ETH that was won in the auction?
Yeah, so we'll just have that on our site, but it's just a one contract call. So we just kind of keep, once we get all the Ethereum, we map everyone's tokens, like their shares essentially to their shares of Ethereum, and then you burn your tokens and you get that Ethereum sent to you. One of the things that was important there, we thought about making it so that anyone could burn for anyone at any given time to I think it would somewhat help the user experience a bit to let someone else, or you could have some type of delegated redemption, but it would break a lot of composability in DeFi applications if all of a sudden like the Uniswap pool just like evaporated into thin air. So we had to make the decision there to basically that it was more important to maintain composability and require a few extra clicks by the end user. Essentially once the buyout is finished, all those tokens are directly pegged to an amount of Ethereum, and those can be redeemed at any time. There's no time frame or anything. You could wait 3 years to redeem them if you wanted to.
That's awesome. I mean, the good part is that there's an incentive for the buyer. Like, they don't have to wait for everyone to exchange. They get the NFT, and then whenever the old owners are ready, they could just exchange for their amount of ETH.
Yeah, exactly.
That's awesome. I like that. And I guess the other thing is just like building the community around fractional. Like, do you think that you'll eventually have some type of governance token long term, or do you think it's more so a project you want to keep internal? I guess, what are the plans for the community on that side of things?
Yeah, there's definitely plans for a fractional governance token at some point. When and what that will look like is still something that we're finalizing our thoughts on and kind of our plans. But I think in the long term, it's been made pretty abundantly clear over the last year that having a governance token and building that community and aligning incentives that way is really important, and also extremely valuable. And so that's definitely something that we plan on doing. And then a little bit more about kind of like community in general. I think one of the things that we're going to focus on a lot kind of long term is making sure that we're building communities both within the individual token holders of particular fractional things, whether that's through like Collabland private Discord chats where you can only the holders of this token can get in. And maybe if you're an artist, you could use that as a way to build community through that or different things. And then also like the larger fractional community and what that would look like. It's super important.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of ways you could do the token. I mean, you could do fees. It could be an index over basically all the NFT shards, like get some percent or baskets. There's a lot of ways you can go about doing it. So I'm pretty excited about that. And I guess just timeline, Andy, what's the what's on the horizon for Fractional?
Yeah, so we're getting very close to launching. We've been on Gurley testnet for a while now, about 2.5 weeks. And things have been pretty good. We've got a lot of really solid user feedback around the different interactions with minting and all of that. And so we're working on some small site upgrades to kind of just like finalize that whole, just all the user flows and make sure everything is really clean on the and straightforward. And then at that point, we have some, what I think are pretty exciting partners who are going to be launching some cool NFTs. The one that is public already is, if people have been following Beanie Maxi's punk comic, you'll be able to earn some fractional shares of the 16 punks that are in the punk comic. I'm very excited about that. I think the idea of baskets of NFTs that have a meaningful connection to each other is much more interesting to me than just like, 25 random punks that are thrown into a basket. And so I'm really excited to see how he and his team continue to like build out that world and everything. And then we have some other exciting partners in the pipeline that we haven't announced yet. But over the next couple of weeks, keep an eye out because we should definitely have some other cool NFTs that'll be launching.
That's awesome. And Andy, who else is working on Fractional with you?
Yeah, so right now I have a co-founder. His name is Nate, but you probably have seen him on crypto Twitter as a crypto samurai. And he's awesome. He does the website and all of our backend and stuff. And I'm just the Solidity guy and been doing a lot of stuff like this and working with partners. And we are definitely pretty actively looking to hire a few more people. So if you work in the crypto space and do something, I probably want to have a conversation with you. But right now it's the two of us. Hopefully we'll be expanding relatively soon.
That's awesome, man. You say just the Solidity dev, like it's so easy to hire. It's so hard to hire for that role. That's awesome, man. And I guess just like last question for you, zooming out, like what are the biggest risks in your opinion to fractionalizing NFTs? Like, I mean, I guess like uptake for the traditional world is probably one, maybe, smart contract risk, maybe, it's probably a slew of concerns, but I guess what are the ones that keep you up at night?
Yeah. So I think, I definitely think that in like the internet digital world, the ideas of ownership are like kind of constantly evolving and changing. And so making sure that you can like keep up with that while also having fractionalization is really important. Kind of like the idea of a metaverse native museum where you rent out your NFT to the museum was not something that people thought about a year ago. Or not many people were, at least. And like that's something that seems like it's going to be a real thing now. And so like who knows what's going to be the next thing in a year, and making sure that fractionalization can keep up with those things and that we can be agile and building new and exciting things around it to keep up with like the crazy fast paced, just like digital age, because fractionalization in and of itself is a very old school thing. It's something that's been around for a long time. So that's one thing. Obviously, people have talked to you about a lot of regulatory concerns, especially in the US around, are there any potentially negative implications around fractionalization? And it's just a lot of unknown right now. But obviously that's something that needs to be kind of sorted out and figured out. But that all regulation will come. The way I feel about that is, in 2017, everyone was worried about what the regulations were on all these DeFi tokens, and it all kind of worked out. So I feel pretty confident that in the long term, that'll all be sorted out. But it definitely is something that at least right now is an unknown. And then I think lastly, I feel very happy with our mechanism design and how we do things. But also, it's a very new and like evolving space. And just I think making sure that we can continue to iterate and build and make sure that we're offering the best possible buyouts and experiences for end users and all of that. And keeping up with layer two development and everything that kind of comes along with that is, I wouldn't say it's like a risk. It's more just something that we have to continue doing and like keep building, but it's not necessarily a risk.
No, that's fair concerns. And I guess just one last like tangential question there. Like, you obviously started your life on Ethereum with MakerDAO. You did a lot on NBA Top Shots with Flow. Now Fractional is built on Ethereum. I guess, do you envision a world where different layer one blockchains have different types of NFTs? And I mean, I guess if so, or if not, do you think, you know, in a different sense that the fractionalized shards through Fractional will trade on other blockchains? Like, it's pretty clear to me that these will probably all go on L2 eventually, because, you know, you don't want to pay $100 to buy a $10 shard on ETH layer one. But
yeah,
I guess I'm wondering your take there.
Yeah, I mean, I can promise you that these are going to be on L2. That is definitely nice. Going to happen. It's something that I've been working through, some potential, what I think are very elegant solutions to the transition from NFT on layer one to fractional shares on layer two. But that can be a podcast for another day. I think that could probably be a podcast in and of itself.
We'll book it right as we hang up on this one.
Sounds good. But yeah, I think long-term, and I think kind of this kind of goes back to what I was talking about earlier. I want to place my first and largest NFT bet on Ethereum. I am very confident in Ethereum long-term and continue to want to build on it. But at the same time, I don't think that Flow is going anywhere, considering that Dapper Labs just raised on like a $1 billion valuation. I have a feeling that they're going to have some staying power, and NFTs are going to continue to be a thing there. And I think it would not be within our best interest to not at least be open-minded to building on Flow or building on Solana should NFTs become popular there, or any of these other platforms. And I don't really see a reason why it couldn't be a multi-blockchain protocol or thing that we're doing.
Yeah, no, I'm totally with you there. It's awesome, Andy. I'm so excited for you at Fractional. I can't wait for it to launch. I'm so amped that you allowed us to back you guys in part with all of your other incredible backers. And I'll let them, you know, share themselves when they're ready. But I'm really excited. I can't wait to, you know, use the platform as well. And I can't wait to have you on again soon, man. And just let people know where to follow you and learn more about Fractional.
Awesome. Yeah. Thanks for having me. My username on basically everything is Andy8052. The origin of that is not very exciting. It's just four numbers that are in a vertical line on a phone keyboard. And otherwise, you can follow Fractional at Fractional_art on Twitter, or Fractional.art is our website. And mostly, honestly, the best place to reach out to me if you ever need me is Twitter. I'm always on Twitter.
I love it. No, I'm looking forward to it, man. And Andy, thanks so much for coming on, man. Really appreciate your time.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed it, please support the show by hitting subscribe on iTunes, writing a review, or sharing this episode on Twitter and LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our next episode out soon.